This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Almost every week, Radio EcoShock details our headlong flight into a complex series of environmental, economic, and social disasters. But where are the solutions? There are many answers out there. What we need is a collection place to gather the things we need to know. Enter Lawrence Beaumart and the Bank of Real Solutions. Beaumart is a longtime New Zealand activist who founded the successful Environmental Business Network in the 1990s. And along with a group called Living Economies, Lawrence co-published and wrote for the book Fleeing Vesuvius, Responding to the Effects of Economic and Environmental Collapse. Lawrence Beaumart is currently on a tour of North America with our previous guest, Nicole Foss. Lawrence, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, hello, Alex. Thank you. And hello to your listeners.
Lawrence, most of the doomers I track picture New Zealand as a place to run after Fukushima or the economy blows up. At least New Zealand could feed itself. Is it all a green garden party there down under?
Well, it does make a great little arc by the fact that there are only 4 million people in an area the size of England, which has over 60 million people. We've got lots of food, but even in the Shire, Alex, the dark shadow of Mordor casts its shadow. Yes, indeed. We have a ex-Merrill Lynch investment banker as our prime minister now, and he's ready to hoover up every last bit of goodness there might be there, but it's not all on his side. But yeah, it's a beautiful place, although here in these northern parts coming up the coast, it looks pretty good up here too. But we do have a small population. It's a great place, and we've pioneered many things, like first country in the world for women to get the vote. We went anti-nuclear back in the 80s, and we've done lots of things like that. And top of the pop charts in America at the moment is a 16-year-old New Zealand girl who's told all those little Disney skanks that they should clean up their act and be real young woman, and that's pretty impressive. So we're pretty outspoken, as you can tell.
And speaking of parties, tell us about the political party you co-founded.
The New Economics Party, and near the end of 2011, 5 weeks out from the general election, myself and Deirdre Kent, a woman in her mid-70s who'd written a book on the monetary system, realized that no one, including our very strong Green Party there, was representing the economic equation. So we thought we needed to put that on the table. So, yeah, we threw that together and went out there and publicly promoted the concepts of the new economy and what's wrong with the old economy.
Well, I do want to talk about solutions with you, but let's peek at a few challenges. Would you care to name your top three things to worry about?
I worry about my own sense of optimism and my own attitudes. That's, you know, so it's the micro-internal level is the first thing. My concern mainly is the combination of factors. If any of the fault lines in the system, you know, we've got a lot of pillars that are the structures of our modern lifestyles. And I'm concerned about several of them going in a domino effect at the same time. The geopolitical tensions are big. You know, how that then impacts on the price of oil. When the price of oil was 147 a barrel, a lot of our world doesn't function when oil is that expensive. And if it goes even sillier and sadder in the Middle East, you know, it could be 200 or 300 a barrel. Back in 2008, due to the economic crisis, I mean, a lot of the pillars of the free market economic system basically failed and collapsed, and they've managed to fake it and kicked the can along the road since then. But, I mean, global shipping wasn't moving for 3 weeks there in 2008 because no one could trust a letter of credit. When AIG, the world's biggest insurer, was failing, well, you can't run business without the insurance industry. There's a whole chain of effects. And if you go into the extreme climatic effects, which are only going to get more extreme, I mean, they affect, you know, world food sources. And when people don't have food, that affects both their social fabric and their economy. So, you know, it's a long, long list, Alex, but you're probably as good at picking it as me. But I'm worried about one thing banging into the other, that we get several shocks at the same time. But overnight, the economic system can fail, as the people of Argentina found back in 2001. Overnight, kaboom, gone. You can't trust your monetary system, or more recently, the people of Cyprus. And that's a sudden adjustment. And that takes a lot of resilience and adaptability. And some people are going to do better than others in that situation.
You've pointed out there are a lot of answers out there. There's solar, there's biomass, there's community currencies, and you have a proposal, and in fact it's working right now, the Bank of Real Solutions. How is that working out for you?
Well, that's basically a website that allows people to upload their local community can-do success story. So the way I see it is as a bit of a recipe book. And I think if everyone has the recipes, then we can all bake the cake. There's always a tragedy of these best solutions that exist and the lag, the time lag between other people picking it up. So it's an extension of kind of what I've been working on for 20 years, which is looking for information on the solutions and bringing that forward as fast as possible and getting it out to as many people as possible. And then looking for ways to give them strategies for action. And so I'm looking at the moment at taking the Bank of Real Solutions into the World Bank of Real Solutions and making it a slightly more complex but fluid platform that many people, a sort of an open source system that many people can link up around bringing forward the best ideas and then looking for funders, workers, people who want to work on those solutions. And I'm looking at upgrading it the next notch. At the moment, it's just in New Zealand. It allows for people to find their local initiatives under a variety of headings, be it health or education or energy and the like or money. It's worked relatively well. It's a good experimental platform, I see it as, for what it can be next. I had a guy in Portland contact me who wanted to use the platform to set something similar up there in Portland. So I want to develop the platform for locals so that anyone around the world can set up similar initiatives. It's amazing how in any region, people often don't know what's happening down the road. So I'm a keen fan of getting the best information into everybody's hands as quickly as possible. And I have played with the extension of that. I have an outline for in New Zealand to get a 24-page mini magazine into every letterbox in the country. I've always looked at all the junk mail and thought, well, what about getting something useful into the hands of people? And so I'm playing with all those ideas of how do you get the information into everybody's hands and what is the best information? Because really, if we used all the best practices we have on the planet now, most of our problems could be solved very quickly.
Well, I'm going to put a link to that Bank of Real Solutions website in my blog at ecoshock.info because I took a look at it and there were some exciting things there that I went, well, I've never thought of that and that could work here. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Lawrence Baumert, the environmental and local economy activist from New Zealand. Lawrence, your speaking tourmate Nicole Foss told our listeners an economic collapse will come well before climate change devastates what is left of the economy of everlasting growth. What is your take?
Oh, well, as I mentioned before, the 2008, basically, you know, that was a bit of an Enron moment. Everybody thought Enron would be there forever, and one morning they got to work and it was all over. It turned out you couldn't run it on horse manure and marketing forever and fraud, and it was gone. And a lot of the mainstream Wall Street and banking system is really an Enron-type Ponzi scheme, and we're just waiting for the next wave, which Nicole says very clearly that was the warning shot across the bows was 2008. So the big moment of reality, the reality ledger is coming. There's the next one coming. So how soon that is, I'm not quite sure, but I'd be surprised to see us on some kind of economic recovery in 2 years' time.
Tell us about the book you are involved with called Fleeing Vesuvius, Responding to the Effects of Economic and Environmental Collapse.
That was actually originally produced by FASTA, an Irish economic think tank back in 2011 in response to the economic collapse in Ireland, and we did a New Zealand edition of it. You know, in Ireland, they were one of the first European countries to hit the reality wall from their false economy, and they bit the bullet and brought in austerity measures to try and get things in order. In their first year after their austerity measures, their GDP dropped by 17%. They had to tell their police to buy their own uniforms, and they dropped their benefits, their social welfare benefits, by 5%. So that was a bit of a rough landing for Ireland, and that's going to be an ongoing thing. Because it doesn't put your economy into recovery when it drops by 17%, I mean, if America really bit the bullet on its budget deficit, it could have to do budget cuts of over $1 trillion in a short space of time. You can only imagine what that would look like. So the book was a response, the byline, a response to economic and environmental collapse. A big part of it is we're no longer just trying to create a sustainable world and avoid the effects of unsustainability, but we actually have to deal with the effects of unsustainability. They're upon us. This is the future. What's happening now is what people for the past four or five decades have been waving their hands around saying, stop, stop, the trajectory we're on, all bad things will happen. Well, this is it. We're here. We're here now, and we've got to deal with it. We've got to do both things at once. We've got to try and build a better, more sustainable future, and we've got to deal with the disruptions that come with hitting the limits to growth.
Can you give us a couple of examples of solutions being tried in New Zealand that are already working?
Some of our local community monetary systems are working really well. We have time banking's taken off. Time banking in the town of Littleton, which was where a big earthquake hit, which leveled the surrounding city quite hard. It is a very robust and resilient system that's building a strong community where people, for doing voluntary effort and doing services in the community, are able to get credits, time credits, for the time they put in. And people are able to build a community chest of time credits for working on community projects and helping the needy in the community. People are building credits for phoning in and on elderly and isolated people in the community, or helping people who are in need in the community. People are able to get a credit for helping meet those social needs, and in turn they can use those credits for things they need, be it childcare or gardening or plumbing or those sort of things. So time banking's a really fabulous initiative that's taking off all across the world. We're also got a let system in the place I live in, Golden Bay, New Zealand. And we have our own paper currency and electronic banking. 10% of our regional population belong to this system. And that allows us to have an increased liquidity in our community for both building businesses, business activity, and meeting social need. And we have a system in New Zealand called BarterCard. And with just 4 million people, we have 7,000 businesses like architects, lawyers, people who own hotel chains, and providing accommodation. These people, 7,000 businesses use this business-to-business system of a non-dollar system, and they use, you know, ATM swipe cards, electronic banking, and that allows for, increased business activity. So it's a real tool for economic development, especially in harder economic times where cash is short.
You know, in the United States, Lawrence, we're seeing shadows of collapse already. Detroit went bankrupt. The federal government is currently shut down. Food stamps stopped working for a few hours, and there were many riots. Is there still time to organize and launch local economies?
Well, it's not an option. And people can, because there are off-the-shelf systems. If you go to ces.org.za, it's a website that comes out of South Africa, and hundreds of let systems around the world are using their platform. It's not that sophisticated, but it's very adequate. It's a great electronic system, and anyone could set up a local currency based on that today. We put out a book, Get a Handle on Hands, which is available as an ebook for $3 that anyone can use, which is a 136-page manual on how to run a local currency. Nicole and I were featured in a book called True Wealth, which you can find on awholenewworld.com. True Wealth, which is the whole culture and thinking of community currencies. So there's a lot of information. There's Bernard Leotard, his writings. He's put out a lot of books on people money, Thomas Greco, and then there's Margaret Kennedy and the book by Edgar Kahn, No More Throwaway People, about time banking. So there's lots of information. Living Economies, website le.org.nz, is a powerhouse of information. Yes, people can set up a currency overnight, and in the, you know, the resiliency for eternity, the transition town type thinking, one of the number one survival tools, I think, next to food is and communication, which I think is the number one that people communicate with in their community in a time of crisis and make sure they can look at their food source, is currency. Because with currency, goodwill will only go so far. But with currency, then people can get entrepreneurial and innovative to meet the needs of the time. Then people can, you know, revamp their workshops and the like to start making, bringing forward the types of technology and services that you need. So there's a great book by Michael Schumann, an American, called Local Dollars, Local Cents. And that is a template for regional economic development, which tells how people, if they pull their money off the planet-killing Ponzi scheme, which is Wall Street, and invest it in the local economies, over $2 to $3 trillion could be put into the regional economies of America. And that could all flow into things like, you know, the whole new healthy local food revolution, which would answer a lot of health needs. It's an exciting opportunity. I'm not a doomer as such. I'm a realist, but I think the crises we have are the opportunity for change and to throw off some of the old systems. You know, I don't think it's the end of the world as we know it. I think it's the end of a world we no longer want or need, and that that doesn't become 21st century humanity. So it's an opportunity now for people to move fast into other systems because our butts are on fire. So we don't have a choice, and we don't change when we're comfortable. The opportunity now, all across, from coming up the Californian coast, Northern California, Oregon, Washington, now moving into Canada, all I see is people doing really good things. You know, the mainstream might still seem to be asleep, but people are doing just this multitude of things, and they're springing up all over the place and multiplying like a good seed bank does of ideas and solutions. I think it's a very promising time on the planet.
Lawrence Bomart, what is next for you, and where do people go to find out more about you and your projects?
Well, I've thrown out some of those websites, but I'm about to start putting out a newsletter, and whereas they can contact me through the realsolutions.org.nz website, they can email me on lawrencebomart@extra.co.nz. That's Lawrence with a U, Bomert, B-O-O-M-E-R-T, Extra without an E, just xtra.co.nz, and I'd love to share information with people, and I'll be producing a newsletter soon as I revamp my Bank of Real Solutions into the World Bank of Real Solutions, which will be a global information sharing platform with a bit of a Kickstarter component, with the mission of best information into action to as many people as possible as fast as possible.
You have been listening to Lawrence Bomart, the New Zealander looking for answers to our combined economic and environmental threats. He runs the Bank of Real Solutions and helped birth the book Fleeing Vesuvius, Responding to the Effects of Economic and Environmental Collapse. You can find more links to the work of Lawrence, including YouTube videos, in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Thank you, Lawrence. Please keep in touch as things develop or even as they fall apart.
Thank you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
Since gaining her PhD in environmental engineering and moving to Stanford University, Sharon Gurji has specialized in the impacts of climate change and food production around the world. Her latest co-authored paper was published in Environmental Research Letters in June 2013. Its title tells us something important for everyone who eats: global crop exposure to critical high temperatures in the reproductive period, historical trends, and future projections. Sharon, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me, Alex.
I was introduced to this subject by an unlikely source. A hippie YouTuber from Texas, if you can believe that, complained his garden flowered but set no fruit because nighttime temperatures stayed too high just at that critical time. Is that related to the paper you published?
So I just published a paper looking at trends in exposure to extreme heat during that critical reproductive period for crops, and then looking into the future to how we expect this to change in the coming decades. So you're absolutely right that the reproductive stage of crops when they flower is that very risky time where if the flower doesn't get fertilized and set into a grain or a fruit, then you're not going to have anything to eat at the end of the season.
So it's not just that it's getting hotter, but it's when it gets hotter that counts for agriculture. Is that right?
Well, again, the reproductive stage is an especially risky time because, if the flower doesn't set you'll have no yield. But it's also true that warming temperatures are also impacting crop yields through other pathways. So, for example, warming temperatures make crops develop faster. And so if they have less days in the season, they gain less biomass and also have less yield at the end of the season. But that's sort of more of a gradual change and more of a, you know, less noticeable change than something like the grain never sets and, again, you have nothing to eat.
Right, I get it. So, well, Lester Brown from the Earth Policy Institute has stressed some major crops, including rice, are already near their temperature limits. What have you heard about that?
Well, it's true that a lot of our major globally traded crops around the world, wheat, corn, rice, and soybean, are already grown near their temperature optimums, and in many cases and in many regions, above their temperature optimums. But I think it's good to make a distinction between temperature limit and optimum, which is to say that if it gets warmer by 1 degree, yields are going to start to decline, but they're not going to fall off the cliff. We're still going to have something to eat. And there are adaptation measures that people are already thinking about proactively to help mitigate some of these declines. But it's definitely something that we need to be thinking about.
And you've published research on efforts to increase wheat yields. It sounds to me like the focus has been on the high production areas with less work so far on the most climate-threatened zones. Is that an accurate perception? And also, a second question, are GMOs the only solution?
Well, those are very difficult questions. I mean, I think, you know, more and more people are starting to think about climate change and starting to factor that into their future planning. So you do have very active plant breeding efforts around the world to try to prepare our crops for future climate conditions. A lot of this is classical plant breeding. It's not necessarily GMO. A lot of this is done by, there's an international network of centers called the Consultative Group on International Agricultural Research. And they do a lot of classical plant breeding. They were behind the Green Revolution in Asia, mostly in Asia and Latin America, that helped increase yields. So they're starting to think ahead about future climate conditions. The paper I published on wheat, what we found was that to date, in the last 30 years, there hasn't been a ton of progress in helping to improve yield potential for wheat in the hottest areas. It's mostly been in the areas like in Northern Africa and South America, where there's already relatively optimal conditions. Places like South Asia, where they're already growing wheat at really hot temperatures already, there needs to be more of a sustained push to try to help develop the future germplasm that's more tolerant to future climate conditions.
Sharon Gurgi, let's get into the details of your recent paper. Maybe we should start with the historic trends. What are the trends in crops related to temperature?
So again, my most recent paper is on looking at these trends in exposure to extreme heat during the reproductive period. So I just want to stress again that this is not looking at all the combined global change and environmental change factors that are impacting yields and you know, how yields are going to change into the future. It's just looking at that reproductive stage. We did look at these four major crops that are referred to earlier, wheat, maize, rice, and soybean, and we looked at all of their major harvested areas around the world. And we found for the last 30 years that there has been a sustained increase in exposure to extreme heat during the reproductive period, especially for wheat and especially in Central and South Asia, which is increasing the risk of production in these areas. For corn, we also found some substantial exposure, but it was in more kind of isolated, scattered regions around the world. For rice and for soybean, we haven't seen a lot of exposure to date, but looking forward into the future using climate model projections, we start to see large nonlinear increases in exposure to reproductive extreme heat for rice and also for corn in tropical areas, because again, a lot of these areas are already growing these major cereal crops near or higher than their optimal temperatures, and there's going to be an increased risk of crossing these critical thresholds in the reproductive stage.
Well, some of this research must use climate models, and they have been criticized by climate skeptics. How good are the models?
Well, this is a very good question. So I think the million-dollar question people want to know is, what is going to be the impact of global climate change on yields 10 years from now, 20 years from now, 30 years from now? So you have multiple layers of uncertainty in trying to answer a question like this. The first is the climate models themselves. Now, the climate models are relatively robust at large spatial scales, and especially when it comes to temperature. They're less robust at looking at what's going to be the rainfall change in, say, the state of California, you know, 30 years from now. So that's a little bit a harder question that climate models don't have quite a good handle on right now. Then you get into the layer of crop models. And crop models, again, they've been developed for different purposes over the years. A lot of times they were developed for the farm level to aid in management decisions. And they're calibrated to the range of current climate conditions, not necessarily, you know, what's going to happen in the future and what's going to happen over large spatial scales. So there's a lot of work to be done in improving the crop models. And then finally, the third layer of uncertainty comes down to how are farmers going to respond to some of the changes we're anticipating in the future. And farmers are adapting all the time to changes in market conditions and climate conditions. So they're going to be able to mitigate some of the projected damages that we may be seeing coming out of the model. So there's multiple layers of uncertainty. And a lot of the times it comes down to what question are you asking? And is it a tractable question that it's possible to answer given the current state of our modeling capabilities?
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with environmental scientist from Stanford, Sharon Gorgi. We're talking about your food supply. Sharon, tell us about your trip to Nicaragua in September 2013.
Well, I had a great year, and I actually just finished up a year as a Fulbright scholar in a new program called the Fulbright Nexus Program, which is focused on doing applied interdisciplinary research to address sustainable development challenges in the Western Hemisphere. So as part of this program, I had the opportunity to spend 3 months in Colombia this year at the International Center for Tropical Agriculture, which is one of these CGIAR centers I referred to previously. And while I was there, I got involved in a project looking at the impacts of climate change on maize and bean production in Central America. And then as part of that project, my contribution was looking at some historical government statistics on yield in Nicaragua and correlating it with weather data in the last 30 or 40 years to see up until now how much has historic climate trends in the region impacted maize and bean yields and what are farmers doing to adapt. So I did have the opportunity to visit Nicaragua. I was there in January, and I went just a few weeks ago, actually in September, and I had the opportunity to visit farms in the northern Pacific Dry Corridor in the province of Madrid. Also, I went to a farm in Granada, which is 2 hours south of Managua. I also had the opportunity in January to go to the Atlantic coast of Nicaragua and talk with people working on sustainable agriculture in that region. I also had a number of meetings with government agencies who are providing the data and also obviously know their country better than anyone and who are able to help explain some of the trends that we're seeing in the data and, you know, potential options that farmers may have in the future to cope with these changes.
And in your slide presentation, I was astounded to learn the forest cover in Nicaragua has been slashed to just one-third of what it was in 1980. So it's not just climate change in these factors of agriculture, but that must impact local weather and ecosystems too. How does deforestation feed back into climate and crop yields?
Well, that's a really good question, and I think it's something that's important for people to keep in mind. So global climate change is happening, and as a big, large world, we need to think about it. But there's a lot of trends happening on smaller spatial scales around the world as well. And in the tropics, deforestation is a big one. So like you said, Nicaragua has lost a third of its forest cover, and this has had large feedback effects actually on regional climate, apart from changes in global greenhouse gases. So, for example, you see a rate of daytime warming in Nicaragua, which is about 3 times higher than the global average in the tropics since the 1970s. And this is a clear consequence of deforestation in the region. Deforestation is also likely changing some of the rainfall patterns in the region, you know, leading to a longer drought period in between the two main rainy seasons, maybe a later start to the rainy season. It's a little harder with the rainfall to tease apart the impacts of deforestation versus some of the global forcings, but there's likely to be some kind of impact. And the other thing about deforestation is that it tends to reduce soil infiltration and increase surface runoff. So you end up with less soil moisture and larger problems with soil erosion, which is already one of the biggest problems facing farmers in Central America.
That's really interesting stuff. And I wonder how farmers are expected to adapt to temperature changes during these key periods for crops that you've studied.
Well, you know, again, it depends on what farmer you're talking about. So there are definitely large differences in adaptive capacity for large-scale commercial farms in the industrialized world as opposed to, you know, small rain-fed farmers in tropical areas. So it depends on what's feasible for different farmers in different situations. in the developing world, you know, there are a lot of gains to be made from things that have nothing to do with climate change. So increasing access to fertilizers or more widespread use of improved seed, better soil management. And these things will help improve yields regardless of, you know, what farmers are doing to deal with additional climate stresses.
Sharon, is it your sense that new developments in things like seeds or changes in crops will be able to overcome the problems expected during a relatively rapid shift of climate? Or is famine more likely to reappear?
Well, this is, again, a very, very difficult question. And when you're talking about things like famine and food security, you get into the realm of governance and economics and markets. You know, a lot of famines around the world have been related to problems in governance rather than, you know, actual amount of yield or amount of food that was produced in a given area. But in terms of trying to plan ahead for future climate conditions, there is a large concerted global effort to try to breed new germplasm that will be more resilient to future climate conditions. The issue is, again, it comes down to governance. So, like, how do you get this improved germplasm to the people who need it most and make sure that it works for them in their context? In Nicaragua, for example, only about 15% of farmers use improved seed to be worth the cost for them, and they tend to prefer to eat the local traditional varieties. So, you know, you can't tell people, oh, well, you have to eat this new thing, which you think tastes like crap. Well, you have to make sure that you have some kind of seed that's acceptable in local market conditions, but also has built in this additional buffering capacity for future climate conditions.
Well, Sharon Gurji, I'm trying to picture a farmer in the developing world, perhaps in Pakistan or China. This family's always grown a certain crop in a certain way based on the seasons and seasonal rain. I'm having a hard time picturing any program that could help that farmer in time if critical temperatures are changed. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think one thing you have to keep in mind is that farmers are already experts in dealing with climate variability. The weather changes from year to year, and farmers have to be able to deal with this variability in order to survive and to thrive. When you're talking about global climate change, you're talking about long-term shifts in the average climate. So it's not the kind of thing that, you know, okay, tomorrow temperatures are going to change. Oh, my God, people have to do something. So it's more a matter of how do you help support farmers in their current efforts to deal with current climate variability and help build in their long-term capacity to deal with change.
Are there a lot of scientists studying the limits of our food crops?
Absolutely. I mean, not only do you have all the people like myself who are focusing on climate change and agriculture, the study of agriculture in itself is one of the longest standing fields of science in human endeavors. People from thousands of years have been trying to improve our crops, get them to grow better under different conditions, you know, come up with new varieties that have characteristics that we want. You know, you already have large research efforts, for example, in the United States, land grant colleges that have agricultural extension services that work directly with farmers. So there's a lot of people all around the world. You know, people obviously are very concerned about their food supplies and their food security, and there's a lot of effort going into making sure that we're going to be able to feed populations around the world in the coming decade.
Well, here's a question I know my listeners are asking themselves, and I'd like to get your viewpoint. Is there a point at which we reach peak food?
Well, I personally don't like that term because I think it's a little bit scary. I think it's a little bit of scaremongering. So, you know, when you talk about peak oil, that's okay. Oil production can decline because we have other options. We have renewables. They may be expensive, but, you know, there's other options. In the case of food, there's no other options. We have to eat. Like, that's all that you can really say. And in terms of dealing with a changing climate and perhaps a degrading environment, there are substantial challenges that remain in terms of us being able to ensure our food supply in the coming centuries. But I think there's a lot of people working on it. I don't think failure is an option, and I think we're going to be able to deal with change. We've been dealing with change as human beings for thousands of years. You know, we don't have to deal with things that were major problems thousands of years ago, like maybe, you know, a wild animal coming into your house in the middle of the night, at least in developed countries. And so, you know, we have new challenges facing us.
Do you have suggestions where listeners can go to dig deeper into this subject?
Well, you know, I think there's been an explosion of information and interest in this field. So, you know, basically doing a web search, you might come up with a lot of great sources. There's a lot of great blogs now that are devoted to food security. One of them is maintained by my boss, David Lobel at Stanford, with some of his collaborators, and it's just called g-seed.com. I think that's a really good source.
Sharon, what are you working on now?
Well, right now I'm finishing up my study for Nicaragua on the impacts of historical climate change on maize and bean production. So what I found so far is that in the case of Nicaragua, maize has been much less impacted by climate trends than red bean. And red bean is very sensitive to climate trends, increases in intensity of rainfall, also seasonal drought in certain areas of the country. And there's definitely been a downward pressure on yields for red beans in the country. And it's interesting because I was just there and I was talking with people, and the country has actually just banned the export of red beans because of concerns about food security. And they're now giving incentives to producers to cultivate black beans, which by chance happen to be more hardy. They're less sensitive to high temperatures and drought. They're trying to get farmers to switch over. Of course, Nicaraguans prefer to eat red beans, not black beans. So they're mostly exporting the black beans abroad. But, you know, it's an evidence of a climate adaptation in action. So my next paper is going to be looking at trying to quantify to what extent farmers are adapting to these changes and what sorts of measures are they using, and what sort of extra support could they use in order to adapt to these additional stresses on their livelihoods.
Our guest has been environmental engineer and crop researcher Sharon Gurgi from Stanford University in California. She's co-author of the paper Global Crop Exposure to Critical High Temperatures in the Reproductive Period, Historical Trends, and Future Projections. Find more links in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Sharon, thank you so much for sharing your time with us today.
Thank you, Alex. It was a great pleasure. I really enjoyed it, and I'm happy for the opportunity to connect with the listeners on your program.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. This is a quick clip from Pittsburgh Power Shift 2013. It's Josh Fox, the director of Gasland. Check this out.
The movement to ban fracking has spread all over the world. In France, we just won. We have the entire country of France banned fracking. The Netherlands just banned fracking. We have a movement to ban fracking in 9 countries in Europe, in South Africa, in Australia. New York State is still frack-free. There are 5 ballot initiatives in Colorado. There's one in Michigan. There's a ban fracking movement in California. But do you know where all of this started? Do you know the first place in the world to ban fracking? That's right. The great city of Pittsburgh. Doug Shields, the city council. It starts here. You're on hallowed ground in Pittsburgh. When the natural gas industry came to my doorstep in the upper Delaware in Pennsylvania, across the state, in the watershed, and I knew that I was surrounded by people who had leased, this was probably the loneliest and scariest day of my life. But I'm not so lonely anymore. How does it happen? How does a room like this happen? I was down in Guy, Arkansas, a place that had 1,000 earthquakes in a year, Arkansas. And I met this lady named Susan Fry. She was the earthquake lady. She had a plumb bob attached to the bottom of her coffee table. Every time it moved, she looked up the earthquake on the website. Sure enough, there was one. Now, most of those quakes were microquakes. But then a 4.7 knocked her husband off of his lazy boy and put cracks in the walls of the local high school. And I imagine that as he hit the ground, something happened. Or Amy Ellsworth in Colorado, who was water was so flammable and contaminated with methane that she could light it on fire out of her sink. She was showering in the dark because she was so afraid that a spark from her light bulb would blow her up in her shower. And I can imagine her standing there dripping, naked, in the dark, terrified. Something happened to her. Or the G family in Tioga County, Pennsylvania. 5 generations on the same land. Shell built a 6-well horizontal fracking pad 200 feet from their bedroom window. Their pond was contaminated. Their water was flammable. They had to sell out and sign a non-disclosure agreement, selling their house of 5 generations to Shell. And as they walked out on their First Amendment rights, forced to walk out on their First Amendment rights to tell their own story, and they left the house and closed the door and realized they didn't need to lock it, I imagine something happened to the G family. Or Lois Frank, my good friend, the former chief of police of the Blood Tribe in Canada, who stood between her ancestral lands and invading fracking trucks. And as she was arrested, the former chief of police, just like so many were arrested in New Brunswick yesterday, I can imagine something happened. With drilling and fracking in 34 states, frac sand mining in half a dozen others, tar sands development in the west, oil shale in California and North Dakota, deep water drilling in the Gulf, superstorms in the east, mountaintop removal for coal destroying Appalachia, the Keystone Pipeline proposed to run straight down the center of this country like a scar that won't heal. We are all members of frontline communities. We are all in the target zone. That's our story. That's what's happening to us. That's why we're here. So, President Obama, what happened to you? We delivered you 650,000 signatures on a petition to ban fracking on public lands. What happened to you that your response was silence? It was a grassroots movement that elected you president. How can you be ignoring the largest grassroots movement for an environmental justice and democratic reform in the last several decades? This is on you. We don't just need you to stop the Keystone XL pipeline. We don't just need you to ban fracking on public lands. We need you to go out there and campaign for us the way we campaigned for you. I know there can be no democracy. There can be no democracy without freedom from fossil fuels. I'll say that again. There can be no democracy without freedom from fossil fuels. I know. I have a coal-fired power plant vibrating in my pocket. The text message reads, LOL, I just blew up your favorite mountain. I have a frack gas well at home in my kitchen. I vote for okra and for brook trout that I caught behind the house. But if I don't storm the streets, then my recipe doesn't include democracy. I have an oil spill on every station in my car radio. I have trails of exhaled carbon floating in supermarket aisles with 3,000-mile tomatoes and 6,000-mile kiwis. And every meal that I eat has a frequent flyer account. Every buzz and click and whir and chime on one or another object to me, clinging to me, is my consent. But I have to remain optimistic. I know we can run the world on renewable energy. I met winemakers in Ardèche, the origin of that ban fracking movement in France. They won. They said, we're fighting off fracking to defend our wine. We have to be optimistic. We make wine. It's our job to make people happy. And as a filmmaker, I feel the same way. And as a participant in this movement, I feel the same way. We are creating change right now. We are creating a change in the climate right now. The change in the political climate, the change in the climate of how it feels when we come together as communities, the change in what it means when we believe in ourselves. That's climate change I can believe in. We have to have values going forward even as things change. We must remain human, as Tim DeChristopher said last time at Power Shift, even as the climate changes. So what do we have to do now? We have to do what feels right. Look, I'm not an organizer. I can't organize a sock drawer. I don't even have a sock drawer. Some of you know what I'm talking about. But I can make a film. So that's what I did. And you have to enter this movement in whatever creative way your individuality summons you to. But that's not all. You have to be a foot soldier. You have to show up. When Bill McKibben and Naomi Klein told me, come and show up in front of the White House and get arrested to stop the Keystone XL, I showed up. And when the great organizers of this movement call upon us to stand in Illinois, to stand in front of the drilling rigs before they roll in, when we pledge to defend that home state of Obama and make it an issue for him, we have to show up. When our Democratic candidates in the state of Pennsylvania, we have 6,000 gas wells in Pennsylvania and 1,000 families have petitioned to the DEP with water contamination. And not single Democratic candidate right now running for governor supports what 62% of Pennsylvanians support, which is a moratorium on all gas drilling and fracking in the state of Pennsylvania. When those Democratic candidates don't stand up for the majority of the people, when the organizers call upon you to bird dog those candidates, those men and women seeking to represent this state, you bird dog them until they support the moratorium. Because if we're not in the streets, if we're not in the streets, we're not anything. I know, movies don't change the world. Our own individuality is a small part of this. Organizing changes the world. Showing up changes the world. And we can find a way, if we can find a way, to take those great collective actions I know that you'll write a great story, you'll write a great song, like the girl right before me, and that you're going to write history and you're going to change the world. Thank you.
That's the director of Gasland, Josh Fox, at Pittsburgh 2013 Power Shift. My next guest is an expert, I think I can say, in Pacific gardening, all the way from California up to Washington State. She's the editor of Pacific Horticulture Magazine. We'll talk about that. She's at the fair making a presentation about rewilding, making room for nature in the city. I know that will interest many of you. So without further ado, Lorene Edwards-Forkner, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
Big topic, rewilding, making room for nature in the city. What is that about?
My notion of it, and I always shy away from the moniker of expert. I prefer to think curious. I'm always learning. I'm by no means feel like I've arrived. The more I learn, the more I know what there's left to learn. So anyway, that's my hesitation at the word expert. But what I have come to enjoy learning more about is this notion of nature as a system, checks and balances and actions and consequences, and how humans fit into that, that nature is no longer a wildlife preserve or a zoo or a, you know, a some place where humans can't, if we show up, we wreck it, and tends to be what happens. And so how can we rewild our notion of what that nature is, and how can we get it back in the city alongside humans? How can we play a role in it, a cooperative role in it?
Well, I think we're talking about more than just parks then, too, because there's all sorts of green things growing in unexpected places in the city.
Nature fills in wherever there's a gap, and that could just as easily be a crack in the sidewalk as, you know, a clogged up gutter. I've seen very invasive butterfly weed bushes blooming three stories off of the ground in a backed up gutter. You know, nature fills in. The butterfly will feed on the nectar of the buddleia bush, and you know, that's its own little ecosystem right there. I don't necessarily recommend planting butterfly bushes because they will seed into your gutters and get a little bit out of hand. But yes, our role to invite nature back into the city, to invite nature back into our gardens, is to leave room for it.
So what should we do then? Should we go to our council meeting? Should we meet with our neighbors? What's the plan to try and make our city a more eco-friendly place?
I think most of all is to, again, it comes back to education. Learn what it is that is going to best support these systems. And, you know, it seems fairly obvious, but pavement. Pavement is kind of a bad thing on all levels. Let's start breaking up the pavement and keeping the water in the land, keeping it on site, which is going to help on a municipal level to waste treatment. We're also, you know, exposing more land to cultivation for nature to move in on. So that, you know, they always say buy land, they're not making it anymore. But every time you break up the pavement or plant a rooftop or put in a garden or even a container garden, you've created a little piece of nature there. You've opened it up again. You are, in essence, making land. And once you learn about the native pollinators, the birds that move through our cities, and you realize what a wasteland or kind of a parking lot, virtual paved over parking lot, our cities become when a native pollinator can only forage out about 300 feet from their nest. Something as simple as the parking lot of your grocery store can be an insurmountable barrier. They can't get from the gardens on one side to the gardens on the other side because it's more than 300 feet. So we have a little ribbon of planting or something with flowers and nectar sources and things that bloom at various times of the year through the middle of it. We make these little corridors and pathways. That's making room for these pollinators and other critters and wild things alongside us. You know, I'm not a proponent of locking humans out of nature.
You've told me something I just did not know at all about these limitations of the pollinators. What about also another big debate that we just had recently on Radio EcoShock due to Orion Magazine had a teleconference about this was whether we should be looking exclusively at trying to put back what was here before we came with native species, or is it okay to have some non-native species that are going to thrive in the new conditions that we've created?
Absolutely. There really isn't a lot of sense in going back because it's unachievable and it's demoralizing and depressing and all those things that kind of stop the process before we even begin. And that's why I'm saying, you know, it's a 21st century way of looking at nature, and it's where we are now. There's a fabulous book called Rambunctious Garden, and she talks about a 21st century hybrid of humans and wildlife management. And it's different. I mean, when you start getting into those native plant conversations, you know, native to what point in time? Native to First Nations? Native to before humans? Native to, you know, even our prairies at one time were forests. So you start spinning your wheels because you're so busy defining what's correct without getting anything done. And even that notion of what is right or correct is a very human construct. You know, nature, meanwhile, is just filling in and doing their work, which is a cautionary tale on import of exotic plants, because so many of them, while seeming to be a perfectly good idea to begin with, whether it be kudzu or the Himalayan blackberries that are all over the Pacific Northwest, the kudzu was brought into the South to control erosions in such a wet climate. It does, and then it swallows the nation whole. I heard a story recently where Scotch broom, which is such a horrible pest on the Pacific coast and does so much in the way of displacing native plants that and can't compete with it, that it started in the late 19th century from three seeds somehow picked up in Hawaii by a Scotsman who was up on Vancouver Island and was nostalgic for home. So sentimentality and that human emotions that's, you know, we can lead us to unwittingly unleash some, you know, plant that can do a lot of damage over time. I'm not saying we can't have our sentimentality in the garden. I've tried to grow a beefsteak tomato in Pacific Northwest. That's very sentimental and naive, but to be aware and to be conscious and responsible for it too.
What are some of the growing conditions that people in the Northwest encounter that people in Arizona or in Ohio would not know about?
We have one of the longest daylight hours in the entire continental United States. Certainly Alaska can beat us out in spades, but in terms of just, you know, our day this morning probably started around 4:30 with daylight, and it will be dusk at close to 10 o'clock. That is a very, very, very long growing season. We also have such moderate temperatures that we can probably cultivate something in the garden and it can be actively growing 8 or 9 months of the year. So between those long days and those long months, we have one of the longest growing seasons in the country. On the other hand, we have almost constant cloud cover. We never get truly hot, although we complain bitterly if things go above about 75, because we have that maritime influence. So it's one of the most hospitable growing conditions in the country, but we really need to learn to love our cool season vegetables and kale and cabbages and beans and, you know, things that will flourish under those hospitable growing conditions we do have, not quite spend so much of our sentimentality trying for that giant beefsteak tomato.
Well, it's too bad the people of Seattle can't grow coffee beans. Then everything would be perfect.
Yeah, we could be completely a closed-loop society.
Well, you're the editor of Pacific Horticulture magazine, and I gather that's not just about Washington State. Tell us what you do cover.
The Pacific Horticulture magazine is actually about 37, 38 years old. It's a nonprofit organization that was put together by various nonprofit horticultural societies on the West Coast looking to collectively publish a journal, a newsletter of sorts. And, you know, nonprofits, we're looking to be efficient and good use of our resources, but we do cover a tremendously diverse growing region. My friends in San Diego have no idea how I, you know, function up here. They come up and visit in June and are just wrapped in blankets. And, you know, I'm down there in February and just nearly giddy with the sunlight. But we also learn from all other parts of the country. I mean, so much of the California area is that Mediterranean climate that, you know, shows up in various parts of the world. It's a very unique growing conditions with the wet winters and the warm, dry summers. And so even though we could be talking about a garden in Santa Barbara, its roots may be in Italy or southern France or, you know, down along the Mediterranean coast or somewhere in New Zealand or Australia. And so it really is a global awareness of how nature works, whether it's, you know, inland Pacific Northwest or coastal San Diego, but interpreted very, very regionally. Because when it comes down to it, it's all about very, very regional gardening. All gardening is local.
We're talking with Lorene Edwards-Faulkner, and you've written 5 gardening books. Would you care to tell us about your latest one?
The latest book is called The Timber Pressed Guide to Vegetable Gardening in the Pacific Northwest. And it was far and away the most blissful book to write because I love to talk about food and I have a very small city garden. I'm not one of those, you know, self-sufficient gardeners. If my beefsteak tomatoes aren't ripening, we'll go to the farmer's market and I'll buy them from the good farmers in Yakima who have sunshine and greenhouses. But I like to talk to people about how they can grow a little bit of food for the longest period of time in their Pacific Northwest garden. They can be harvesting fava beans that they've overwintered first thing in the spring. They can be picking salad greens almost every month of the year. We can enjoy that brief sunny, hot period we get in August and September, but all the good food that comes in between all the other months as well.
And you're giving a workshop at the Mother Earth News Fair on cultivating secondary crops for innovative cooking. What's that about?
Yeah, that sounds all very heady and scientific. I call it nose-to-tail eating in the vegetable garden. And butchers talk about this all the time, about being efficient with the whole hog, as it were, and all the, you know, some of them talk about the nasty bits, you know, the organ meat and the offal and, you know, the things you don't want to look at. Doing so in the vegetable garden is not nearly so frightening, and nothing is really nasty.
There's all sorts of little temperature gauges out there in the garden. I talked with a gardener from Texas who said he didn't get his tomato plants because they had a hot spell where it didn't cool down to about 68 degrees at night. And when that happened, it flowered. Mm-hmm. There were bees buzzing around. No fruit set.
Yeah, yeah. The flowers become sterile. They're inactive. They're non-functioning. You know, that may be the next awareness of our pollination kind of tragicomedy that we're working out. You know, we're learning about the importance of the pollinators on the food we eat, but we're going to start to discover how the climate affects that pollination factors too. And that's going to be another wave.
That's something I've been talking to a few gardeners about is preparing sort of for the extreme garden, because maybe a little less in the Pacific Northwest, but in many parts of the United States and other parts of the world, Australia in particular too, you get heat waves, you get sudden violent storms, you get hail storms, you can get extreme rainfall events where suddenly 3, 4, 5 inches of rain fall, so you've got to have your garden set up to manage that. You don't want everything flooded mm-hmm. out and washed away. Mm-hmm. Especially if it's seeding time. Do you have any thoughts on that? Like, how are people going to be a little bit more agile and still get the food they
love?
That's
a really good way. And it sort of fits into that definition of rewilding, because, you know, Mother Nature's done plenty of rewilding in the last 12 to 18 months. I've seen a lot of personal friends who have lost their entire shade canopy with tremendous freak ice storm event that we had here in the Pacific Northwest. We saw Superstorm Sandy literally bring the beach all up over, you know, parts of New York, and incredibly toxic conditions for growing things. I think more and more people are going to start growing more perennial crops of food, getting back to fruit trees and shrubs and, you know, the asparagus, the rhubarb, the things that are going, they're just a lot more resilient plants. Their roots are going to hold the ground in place. We're going to seed things around them, but they're going to be our anchors in the landscape. So many people I mean, almost anybody with a home who's taking care of their landscape is putting in woody plants and trees and shrubs and seeding things and perennials. And if we just start replacing those, kind of parting out the non-productive plants with more productive plants, we can have our shade tree and our apple crop or walnuts or something like that. And that's going to be a more resilient food production system than those open fields that can wash away.
Those are some great ideas. Laureen Edwards-Forkner, how do people follow up with you? Do you have a blog? And certainly, would you give us your website?
I will give a couple of websites. PacificHorticulture.org is the website for the magazine. We publish most of our content that we print in the magazine, which comes out four times a year, but we publish most of it online. We're a nonprofit organization. We're just trying to educate and inspire. So we give it away freely. And then my own personal website is called Planted at Home. I live and work and garden and toil from home, and so that seemed appropriate.
And that's plantedathome.com?
Plantedathome.com. Yeah.
Great. Thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex.
We are out of time once again. I'm Alex Smith. Get links for this show and my show blog at ecoshock.info. Back the program and get free downloads at the website ecoshock.org. Welcome to all our new listeners, and thank you for listening and caring about your world.